nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Brian is a graduate of the University of Massachusetts some years ago, and then he moved to NIST, and he's done some really cool studies there on film wrinkling, particularly Northfold. And then he moved to Arizona State University, where he was intimately part of that Army-sponsored display center for some years. And then he moved to Akron and did some really cool stuff he's going to talk about. And Brian?
All right. Well, thanks, Miko. So I'll start by saying roll-to-roll processing. I would have, moving to Akron, that's sort of what I learned. I went from plate-to-plate, which is what ASU used. And so Miko sort of got me interested in doing some of this stuff. And so really what I want to tell you about today is how scaling up some of these self-assembled materials by using roll-to-roll processing can allow us to start developing some new concepts and some new ways of looking at things. So just to give you a little brief overview of sort of where my group is at and what we work in, we work on a sort of plethora of different problems. And really, if you look at any one of these, they seem to be somewhat disparate and not really related to each other. But really what we're trying to do is focus on really developing some really deep fundamental understanding through measurements and measurement technology development to enable improved processes and properties in these things. So just give you a brief overview of a couple of these areas. One is in 3D printing of polymers, which I've been working on with Miko before he decided to move over to Purdue. In this case here, really what we're thinking about is a big challenge with these 3D printed parts, especially the ones printed from these desktop 3D printers that are using melt filaments. You end up getting this sort of grain-type structure in the material, and these things will fracture and crack along this direction, just like a piece of wood would crack along its grain. And so what we wanted to do was come up and develop some fundamental measurements in terms of understanding temperature history, some process history information. From that, we've been able to develop some process structure relationships, understanding how voids, how defects get put in these materials, and then we've been able to basically exploit understanding of this as well as our measurements to be able to develop new formulations where a part before that would crack, now we can have very high impact. The crack doesn't propagate. It's a stress whitening area in here, and you can actually see fibril structures with a little bit of pullet. It's almost like a self-made, fully polymeric composite material. Looking at ice crystallization, sounds completely different, but it's actually sort of coming about it from the same type of direction. There's been some work and some interest on using hydrogels as the substrates for making flexible electronics. These are nice because the properties of these hydrogels can be just very similar to the skin. You're not going to have to worry about if you stick a piece of plastic on the skin, you're getting that nice sweaty feeling. This here is going to be able to breathe. You're going to be able to get stuff through. The challenge is that if, you know, you're working out, you have a hydrogel sensor that tells you about your great workout and you leave it in your car in West Lafayette in January on a really cold day, what's going to happen is the same thing that happens with water that's inside of a rock. You're going to end up having expansion due to ice formation. It will cause cracking. It's going to cause your device to probably fail. So what we thought was, well, if you look at it, nature's developed some really cool things. So here's a toad that actually buries itself a little bit in the ground, makes itself look like a rock, it frosts over, but it doesn't die. And the reason why it can basically come back to life in the spring is because it actually confines the water inside of its system, prevents very large crystals from growing that will destroy the cells. And so what we were thinking is, well, can we make hydrogels that will similarly confine water to length scales that would be appropriate on the order of a couple nanometers between some hydrophobic units, and will this prevent water formation? So we've done some measurements on measuring what the structure is with X-ray scattering, and then by understanding where we are confined, how it relates to the natural system, we've been able to make hydrogels. Here, this is heat flow versus temperature. This material here is about 60% water, 65% water. And if you notice on cooling, we don't see any nice spike peak that's associated with water crystallization. So we have, if we actually heat this back up, we find less than 1% weight percent water, or one weight percent of the water in the system has been frozen. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on organic electronics and the processing perspective on this. How can we look at this. Well, the performance really depends upon how you process the materials. So here's exactly the same material, spin coating down some transistors at different speeds. This will control a drying rate, and you can see that almost an order of magnitude change in my mobility or the performance of the device in this way. What we were really interested in when we were going this direction was looking at some of these organic photovoltaic devices where you get quite poor performance if you cast it from most organic solvents like toluene. You cast it from a halogenated solvent, you end up with much better performance. But if I'm going to actually put this in the industrial process, large sums of halogenated solvent is not going to really be a good idea. So we went back, looked at the thermodynamics of the system, picked some solvents that were non-halogenated that sort of give us, in sort of a phase space about the thermodynamics of the solvents, something that will sort of look like dichlorobenzene on drying. And the blue line is our non-halogenated system versus the red one, which is halogenated. And so we can actually get performance that's pretty similar. And so by understanding what we have going on in terms of the thermodynamics of the system, we can start solving problems that are important. So today what I'm going to do is sort of really focus on two areas. One, looking at beyond lithium-ion battery technologies and coupling that with roll-to-roll processing of self-assembled materials, where we're focused on low-cost materials, being able to develop really long lifetime, and being able to do very large-scale fabrication of this. And so our interest really is thinking about three key considerations. The first is, how do you do this at a very low cost? The second is, if we start putting nanomaterials into some device and you're going to make it, you've got to have a clear advantage of that over the competition. And we want to think about some of the health and safety side of things. Is it actually going to be able to become commercializable? And so really what we want to do is go from this here, where in many cases these nanomaterials you're making less than 100 milligrams, to something much closer to this here, where you're making kilograms of material at a time. And so we need to understand our process. And so how we sort of look at this in my group is thinking about the translation from the lab to commercial products and trying to minimize this valley of death where you have the proof of concept, where if we can, in the basic research and the beginning of the applied research stage, think about these problems in terms of the manufacturability and using scalable techniques, we'll be able to improve the ability to translate this. In addition to being able to think about it this way, we have a couple other advantages. First is students can make a lot more material. Students like having a lot more material around because if they make a mistake, you don't have to go back and redo it so many times. It's a lot, enabled some new potential applications to be examined, especially when, you know, collaborator comes to me and he tells me I only need 10 grams of this nanomaterial. It's not really a lot. I only need 10 grams. And the typical batch size reported in the literature is 100 milligrams. You know, takes 2 days to do each one. You can start thinking about that as a student. You may not be happy about trying to make that. If we can scale it up and do it in 1 day, now you can start looking at some new applications. And it's really good at promoting some collaborations, as the student time to providing the materials is actually low because we can start adding extra amounts of material in as we're making it for our own project. And so what I'm going to talk about today in terms of this battery technology with the scalability really is motivated by energy and climate change. And so focusing on this graph here on the left, we're looking at sort of this human development index, which describes basically the health, the education level, and the standard of living of different countries. And what you can notice is there's a very sharp increase in your standard of living until you get to about 2 to 4 kilowatt hours per person of energy consumption. And so if you don't have enough energy, you're not going to be having as long of a lifetime. Education level is going to be lower and the living standard is lower. And so what we'd really like to do is, how do you make and allow the rest of the world, specifically sub-Saharan Africa and South America, grow? As you can see, sort of these are the bubble graphs looking at the CO2 emissions. And you can see that neither of these are close to the actual size of the countries. They're actually underrepresented in terms of their energy use. So if we assume that we need 4 kilowatts per person to get this HDI of 0.8, We need 28 terawatt hours total per person currently, and that would double our energy demand on arrival. And so how do you actually do this without ending up doubling our CO2 emissions? And so what you need to do is you need to start looking at this renewable energy slice and how do we grow this and being able to motivate new cleaner energy conversion devices. And so there's actually things that have been developed that work really well. Solar and wind power are actually quite economical at this point. Fraunhofer had come out in a study a handful of years ago looking at offshore wind or onshore wind power, and it's pretty competitive with most coal technologies, at least in Europe. And so you actually have a relatively low cost. No one wants to pay extra for their electricity. The challenge is in this bucket here. How do you control the electricity on the back end where I now have power production that can't be regulated because the wind's going to blow when it blows, but people are going to want and take the power consumption when they want stuff. And so how do you control stuff on this back end? And everything is driven by cost in these cases. And so this actually gives you an opportunity for batteries, but most of the battery technology where people have been developing everything is focused on lithium-ion batteries. Why? Because they're really good on the consumer electronic and electronic vehicles. Where what? What's the important thing? Weight. I don't want to have a cell phone that weighs 20 pounds sitting in my hand to be able to power things. I need low weight. Lithium-ion batteries give us a low weight. If you think about a stationary energy storage where I can now store the energy that's being harvested, from solar cells in the sun, I don't necessarily care about the weight. I care much more about the cost. And so what we need is basically long battery lifetime and low cost for these here, as well as a safety issue. And so if you look at energy, the energy density for some battery platforms versus time to maturity, the two most commercialized ones, right, are the nickel metal hydrides, and lithium ion batteries. There's some new ones that have come out now that use lithium metal anodes. Basically, the biggest jump you're going to get with lithium ion is to going to lithium metal on the anode side. And then there's some other technologies that are a little bit further off. Challenge here is you're still going to have to use a lot of lithium. So if Elon Musk is correct and we get everyone to now move over to nice electric vehicles, or if France's motion to go to electric vehicles takes off, something closer to this high trend line for the lithium demand is going to occur. We will end up utilizing basically all of the readily available lithium, and we're going to have a very small amount of stuff available. And this difference between the low availability and high availability is going to drive the price up tremendously, which is going to then adversely affect the ability for this to be used on the electronic side. So what we've done is we, along with some other groups, started thinking about this. And so if you think about lithium, you're down here in terms of its elemental abundance in the crust. You get about three orders of magnitude increase in the abundance with sodium. You can get sodium very easily. So if we went to sodium, we now have something that's going to be much more available. The challenge is because the sodium weighs more, it's going to have slower kinetics as well as lower capacity per mass. And so you have things such as sodium ion as well as these sodium sulfur batteries that have been developed. What's interesting here is if you look at the sodium sulfur, it sort of is looking at like it's in the similar range in terms of energy density that of some of these lithium ion batteries that use lithium metal. So if we could develop something in this range, we could actually go places. And of course, it's already been done. High temperature sodium sulfur batteries were developed, these things manufactured in Japan for stationary energy storage since 2002. This gave you 90% efficiency on your lifetime on these, so these things can actually cycle for quite some time. Problem was, about 6 years ago, you had this very major fire because these things here at high temperature, what you're using is you're using molten sodium and molten sulfur, both of them that are nice and corrosive. And so if you corrode your cell away and you get a little bit of leak, you now have something that is over 300 degrees C with sodium metal being exposed to air. It burns really fast, and then it will heat everything up around it, And basically it took off and these big cells just started popping. And so it burnt down the entire facility. They've stopped production because of corrosion at high temperature led to a safety fault. And so if you can't have safety in your batteries, as you all know, you can't take them on planes like the Samsung Note. This was a slightly larger one because this is now industrially sized batteries. And so how do you get this advantage with taking away this safety issue? And so one thing you can do is go, okay, well, can we just do the same thing we do with a normal lithium ion battery? Run these things at room temperature using liquid electrolytes, using sodium. And so you can actually take sodium with some sulfur and run across through the liquid electrolytes. The problem with the liquid electrolytes is the reaction cascade for the sodium reacting with the sulfur goes through these high polysulfides, which are soluble in almost all of these electrolytes. And so what you end up doing is you end up dissolving your sulfur in the solution. And as you're going through and doing a charge cycle, these sulfides can migrate over to the sodium deposit, and now I've lost my active material. My battery fades quite readily. There's ways you can start putting some modifiers in here, start engineering the whole system, and you can get things that sort of run. And you can see here we've got decent capacity on this battery, and it sort of fades, though. So you go from above 200 to about 180 through about 500 cycles. If you remember back for the stationary energy storage, they needed about 3,500 cycles for a lifetime on this. This thing's fading way too fast, and so we need to slow that down. The issues here is the sulfur isn't conductive, so we need to be able to transfer the electrons in the sulfur. This polysulfide shuttling back and forth, which really influences the reversibility of these. And so one way to try to take care of some of this conductive side is to make highly porous, highly conductive fillers where you can fill the material with my sulfur components. And so now my lithium or my sodium ions and my polysulfides are attached closely to a fully connected 3D network of conductors so I can get my electrons in and out of the system. Performance here depends upon the pore size. Is smaller actually better? Not always. And the pore chemistry. And so the question that then arises is how to maximize the amount of sulfur I have in the system so I can get the highest capacity while maintaining the highest retention possible while still dealing with this low cost for the synthesis. And so what we started thinking about is self-assembly. Nature uses very simple units of peptides to build up quite complex nanostructures that then can assemble into much larger ideas. And so we thought about sending these to other systems. And so what we used is the same thing that everyone from UMass uses, which is a block copolymer. In this case here, what we have is a polymeric material that has hydrophobic section connected covalently to a hydrophilic section. So these will self-assemble into periodic structures because these A and B blocks dislike each other, but they're covalently connected, so you can't have macrophase separation. So you can think of oil and water, where the oil and water are connected to each other. And you can get a handful of different structures. And if we start making these things more complex, we can make even more complex structures. And the size that we get here is just driven by basically the size of the block copolymer we have. Now, this sounds nice, except for every single time I have to do something and I want to change geometry or change the structure, I need to synthesize a new material. And from a scalable perspective, that doesn't necessarily make the most sense. And so what we've done was taking some of these concepts from the literature about cooperative assembly, where you now take a block copolymer along with some precursor that's now giving you your functionality that you want. And in this case here, we're going to have hydrogen bonding between our precursor and the polyethylene oxide units. And so as we just add more and more precursor, we can move across phase diagrams, changing what structure we have by the relative volume fraction of the components. And so here is one block copolymer. Here's the initial block copolymer. It forms a poorly ordered spherical phase. Adding some of this precursor into the solution gives us cylinders and the gyroids into multi-layer vesicles into back to gyroid and then into cylinders. And so from one material, we can make large number of different nanostructures. And so there's been a lot of work in this area of cooperative assembly, making diverse number of materials such as metal sulfides, mixed metal oxides. There's been some carbide materials that have come out recently. And what we decided we wanted to be interested in is making this carbon silicon. The reason for this is carbon is inert, so we don't have to worry about it reacting in the system, in the battery, and we can get really cheap precursors to make carbon. And so we're taking some work from Jack's paper from Dongyan Zhao's group at Fudan, where you took a commercially available block copolymer. This PF is a phenolic resin, so this is the same thing that holds your particle board together. It's not quite as cheap as dirt, but pretty close. And we took tetraethyl orthosilicate in this case here, but we've also done some with sodium silicate, so we have a lower-cost silica precursors. Assemble all of these together. It will form these nice ordered phases where we have our hydrophobic regions forming pores when we heat this up at high temperature to form either polymer silica composites. We can carbonize it. And what we're really interested in is etching out everything, because now I can make very large surface area carbons. We're actually going to use a KOH microwave etch instead of HF etching to get this out and make large amounts of material. The challenge with this is actually in the scale-up. And so there's been a lot of work trying to scale these things up. So large batch synthesis of making these type of materials. If you notice, there's a 24-hour stirring process followed by 48 hours, followed by 2 hours with a wash and filtering and then a drying and then 6 more hours. And so it takes a long time, and these things are highly dependent upon the size of the container you use. For the carbon materials, Dongyan Zhao's group sort of decided they want to make a kilogram of material. And they took foam blocks of urethane and they dropped their solution into it and let the solution dry out so it will assemble. It gives you very large surface area, but you have to wait for everything to dry so it assembles properly. So it takes a week to make these things here as the stuff dries. And the drying process is critical. And so these things become long fabrication batch processes. But we're making carbon. So if you think about it, there's a lot of things where people have made carbon before and they've done it making large sums of it. The easiest idea is in carbon fiber production. So if you look at Dispatch Industries' more recent one, they take with polyacrylonitrile fibers coming in, and you can go out in a continuous process coming out at the end making our carbon fibers. And so we thought, hey, MECO has this great roll-to-roll processing facility at Akron where we're able to now cast material, and then we can actually do post-processing down on the back end where maybe we can, as a proof of concept, determine if this is going to work. And so we're going to take this well-defined processing technique where they're generally making 100 milligrams, and we're going to doctor blade cast this, evaporate our solvent, and then go through a heating process where we can cross-link our material on this and then actually peel this cross-link material off. The first thing we wanted to do was actually understand the reaction time on this and the reaction kinetics. And the reason for that is, in the literature, they are not concerned about how fast you make anything. They are just concerned, do I get the product or not? And so there was this cross-linking reaction that they said took 24 hours at 120 degrees in order to get a nice ordered structure. I did not want to have it tell MECO that he couldn't use his machine for 24 hours. So decided, okay, let's go through and let's look carefully. We went through, we developed and examined carefully the cross-linking reaction kinetics. There was 5 reactions that occurred. We can use FTR, Fowler conversion, as a function of time through here. And we found that you had to get up to about 80% conversion for things to work. And then we went through and we developed a sort of a 2-step process, and we've actually now been able to go to a 3-step and decrease it down. So this was 3-hour process forming the same structure. We're now down to about 35 minutes in forming the structure. And so what you get at the end is this nice orange sheet. It doesn't look very pretty. It's this cast material. Why this is orange is because of the phenolic resin. when it's cross-linked, you basically have all of these aromatic rings in there. It looks sort of like Kapton, is one way to put it. These are about 500 microns thick. If you take this, you put it in a furnace, you carbonize it quickly, you can end up making these beautiful ordered structures. And these things look basically the same thing as what we got in the small batch powders. But we're able to now make kilograms at one time. I just run this thing for however long I want. I make as much material as I want. So can you use these? If you take the ordered mesoporous carbons, you fill them with some amount of sulfur, you start doing charge discharge on them, you can actually run these. These things look okay, but if you notice here, here's my specific capacity versus cycle number. You'll watch these things, no matter what they do, these things are all fading pretty rapidly. And the reason for that is, again, this polysulfide shuttling. Linda Nazar's group sort of went through and started trying to go, well, how do we change this? How do we modify how this is done? And they looked at something simple like a graphene sheet, and you start substituting on the graphene, putting in some nitrogen atoms as well as, or nitrogen and sulfur, and you can look at how the sulfur binds with this surface. And they found at really high levels of sulfur and nitrogen doping on the graphene surface, you can actually really effectively bind polysulfides to the surface. And so their proof of concept, what they showed was, here's the capacity versus cycle number. Everything else is done the same. You can watch all of these fade quite rapidly, whereas if they have that high doping level, the fade has gone down significantly. However, their doping level is limited to about 8% total of heteroatoms in the system. And the reason for that comes in to two ways, two reasons, and that's about how the doping has been done. The one easy way to do this is just add in some precursor that will give you the heteroatom you want. So if I want nitrogen, I could put something like dopamine in the system. I have my nitrogen group. But I'm adding a whole bunch of carbon with it. So you can only put so much in there in the system, and so your quantity of dopant is limited in order to obtain the structure that you want. The other way that people have done things is you start post-carbonization doping, where you start with something, let's say, like graphene, and you try to get this stuff to chemically activate and change. Well, graphene sheets, the reason why we're all interested in them for batteries is they're relatively inert. So I'm taking something that's hard to react and I'm trying to change it, which doesn't really work well. And so what we're doing is we're thinking about coming up with an intermediate doping that can overcome these. And so our idea was, well, since we can make lots of material, we can try lots of different things. And so we took our material that we made, this assembled material with the carbon precursor and the silica in it. We go to an intermediate step where we've made this thing still polymeric, but now it's porous. And then we just fill the pores in with the dopant. So now I can add a lot more dopant. We're going to use melamine in here. Any of the excess dopant actually doesn't turn into carbon because it's not cross-linked on itself. But what it does do is it forms a whole bunch of radicals here, and it's highly reactive in the wall as this stuff is forming the carbon, and so we should end up with these doped carbons at the end. And so the answer to the question is, does it work, is yes. So here's basically the fraction of heteroatoms in the network of the carbon as a function of the dopant to the polymer ratio. So we have to go a little bit up. But you can get 25% nitrogen in these systems without really trying too hard, and we're using relatively simple precursors. As you add the nitrogen in this, it swells the framework, it decreases our surface area a little bit, but we're still able to maintain things that have over 1,500 square meters per gram. So we have really high surface area, and now I have controlled nitrogen doping over quite a large range. To show you that the stuff's indeed nitrogen doped, we ground up some of the samples in the middle, went across, did stem across this, and you can see that the nitrogen and the carbon peaks correspond really nicely. We can also do it by putting sulfur in. Everything sort of matches up. And so what we're seeing is that the sulfur and the nitrogen are basically mixed everywhere in the system. It's not just on an edge. Now, if you recall, the original simulation said, no, we don't want just nitrogen or just sulfur. We want both. So we thought, well, what if we take melamine and benzyl disulfide, mix the things together, put it in here, can we get co-doped materials? And the answer is sort of yes. So we get nitrogen and a ton of nitrogen and a little teeny bit of sulfur left behind, But our nitrogen level, before we could only get about 25%, we were able to get up to 40% nitrogen now. So I have a huge amount of nitrogen. And the reason is the sulfur is larger, much larger than the carbon. The nitrogen is much closer in size. The nitrogen that's sitting around will actually replace the sulfur preferentially. We get a mostly pyrolytic and pyridinic nitrogen in the system, which is actually what you want in order to bind the sulfur. And so first question I had for the student is, can we get stuff into these pores? Does it work? And so what we did was we took material, we infused just at high temperature the sulfur into the porous materials, and we took a look at them. So if we do X-ray diffraction, here's the X-ray diffraction for sulfur. Sulfur forms an 8-member ring in the molecular level that crystallizes. This is the crystal structure for that. Here's my highly doped carbon. It sort of has these nice broad peaks because the carbon in these materials is not highly crystalline. It's an amorphous hard carbon. Get the same thing if I don't dope it. Now when I fill these, I can actually tell that they're filled in these by doing TGA afterwards. Both of these have about 45% sulfur in them. This one here, if you notice, if you look carefully, you might be able to make out a little teeny bit of an extra diffraction peak here. Whereas the one that doesn't have any doping, you can see obviously that you have crystalline sulfur in it. And so this strong binding actually has inhibited the crystallization. And so we're able to hopefully be able to avoid this shuttling. And so we can actually start understanding this filling process. Nice thing is the electron density of graphite and sulfur are almost the same. So if I do X-ray scattering, I can actually watch the time of these pores fill in. And I'm able to show that it's really difficult to fill all the pores, which is exactly what we don't want to do, because if I have it filled, I can't get the sodium ions into it. And so now we have a way to actually be able to probe and determine how quickly we need to go to, or how quickly we can actually fill this to the level that we want. And so we're going back to Brookhaven shortly to fill in between 0 and 15 minute point. To illustrate that this stuff really helps and really helps this polysulfide shuttling, we did this diffusion inhibition measurement. So we took TEMGE, so it's a glycerol-based electrolyte that's commonly used, dissolved sodium sulfide in one side and left the other side open. And in here, I put a little membrane across it, and I packed on the membrane either this undoped porous carbon or the post-porous carbon, and I just let it sit and take pictures. And what you can see here is if I have this doped one, you barely get anything through. The sulfides are a little bit heavy, and they don't necessarily mix that well, but they come through. The one that doesn't have any doping, this stuff comes through quite readily. And so you can actually see that you are getting a quite significant advantage with these dope systems when I have even a huge excess of material here that might be able to diffuse through the system. So the question then is, does it work? And the answer is, if I'm here talking about it, yes. Here's my discharge capacity for a sodium sulfur battery as a number of cycles. So there's a little green dot here that's almost the exact same spot as my doped one because I have the same amount of sulfur in the system. First time I run this, they behave exactly the same. Here's cycle number 2 on the one where I don't have doping. And here's cycle number 2 on the one that I have doping. This stays quite constant, and at high level. And basically we've lost everything without the doping because in this case here I've picked conditions that will allow the polysulfides to diffuse in and out of this system really easily. And so we can actually see as well, looking at the discharge product on the end of this, that we have sodium binding with the nitrogen from XPS analysis. So I can actually show that indeed the mechanism is not only the sulfur binding, but I also have the sodium that is attached to those polysulfides also seems to want to get bound in the system. So this gives me a really nice increase in stability of the doped carbons. Now, if we look at this, here's my discharge capacity as a function of cycle, because what did we want to do? They said that we wanted 3,500 cycles. And so I told my student, no, I want to run 10,000. 6.5 months later, student came back and goes, here's my data. We ran at a really high rate, almost 5 amps per gram. And so that's why this capacity is a little bit lower than before, but we're still staying at around 100. And it's really stable except for these periodic spikes. And so I'm like, okay, well, there's a problem with this. You need to go back and rerun this. I know you're ready to graduate, but you need to rerun these a couple more times. And the student was like, I don't think so. So he took these cells apart, looked at these here. You can see here's the separator on the one that had the doped carbon on the electrodes. It still stays white. This one here, you can see the yellow. That yellow is the sulfur. And so he said, well, actually, I'm looking back at this thing here in these spikes. This is actually a really, really hot August day or August month. University was saving money. Weekend, 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 and this is a long weekend. And so I'm like, well, now at least you're looking at stuff, so we're able to see what's going on. So can we prove it? And so we just went back and we built another cell with this doped one, and we controlled the temperature a lot better. And so here's at 24 degrees, 28 degrees, 32 degrees. You can see we get about 15% enhancement in the capacity as we go up, and I cool it back down to 24 and I get the same number back. And so all that spike up and down was temperature. But now if you think about this, it actually makes really a lot of sense, because what do we have? We have this strong binding event. If I have a strong binding event, it should be Arrhenius, which means I should have some temperature dependencies on this. And so, of course, I'm going to be able to see this here, because some of the sulfur is bound on these materials so tightly, I'm not actually able to utilize it. And when I go to slightly higher temperature, now I'm able to utilize it. And so what we think is we're going to have to go, we're going back right now, and we went too far with the doping. And we're going to back this doping off to try to get our discharge capacity up a little bit higher and be able to have high utilization while still not losing any of the material. And in doing that, we're going to have a couple issues, because not everything is ever solved in the first state. The first one is we only had about 50% mass of this porous carbon being sulfur. And so that doesn't sound like a big deal, except for the fact that what you want is you want your active material, as much of it in your electrode as possible. And so what we've been doing is we've been working on ways to be able to basically blow up the size of the pores without increasing the pore wall size very much. And in doing so, what I can do is I can get to much higher levels. And so we've made these Howell multi-shell carbon materials. We can fill these with about 85% active sulfur now inside of our electrode materials, and we can still get the same doping on these. The other issue is my discharge product. If I showed you these capacities, and they looked stable, but they're a little bit low. And the reason why they were low is my overall reaction is supposed to go from sodium into sodium to SX, where I usually get up to 8. The problem is coming back on the discharge, do you get all the way down? Based upon all of our data that we have, we've done some electrochemical impedance analysis on the products as we're going through the charge. We're getting something around 628 as our theoretical level, because we're only getting to Na2, S2. If we can actually get it so my sulfur isn't bound quite as tight and I can get to this final discharge product, I more or less double my possible capacity. However, this might be one of those nice bad trade-offs where in order to get here, I start having the shuttling issue again. And so we're trying to understand and being able to optimize doping levels for this trade-off between capacity and stability. So like to conclude here, and hopefully I was able to show you that this roll-to-roll processing is an effective way to make some of these ordered materials as well as some other nanomaterials. The processing really matters. Trying to understand the kinetics and the thermodynamics, especially if you're starting to make large amounts of material, becomes really important, so you're not A, wasting a bunch of material, but B, also not taking forever to actually make it. We were able to use this intermediate mesoporous polymer to get some very high doping levels in a number of different materials, different heteroatoms into it. When we put this very high nitrogen doping into this material, we were able to inhibit polysulfide shuttling as well as the crystallization of the sulfur in the pores. Able to get to 10,000 cycles using this without much fade, and anything that we saw was basically up and down due to temperature. And it looks like we're going to have some sort of trade-off in capacity and lifetime that's based on these doping levels as we go forward. Last thing I'd like to do is acknowledge people that did the work. Student Zhe Cheng, who's right back here, basically did almost all of it. He's now postdoc at Northwestern. Funding on this was through two different NSF grants at CBIT. Electrochemical side of things, work with assistant professor, soon to be associate professor, Yuzhu in polymer science, and then have to thank Miko for all of his help on the roll-to-roll side. And thank Masa and Kevin Yeager at Brookhaven for the X-ray time. And with that, be happy to take any questions. Ellie.
You mentioned some of this roll-to-roll. Have you studied what is the uniformity, what kind of variations you can get?
So there's two things. It's a matter of what type of uniformity are you talking about and what type of distributions you're looking at. So with these ones here, we don't care about how smooth the film is, everything else. What we do care about is locally, is this one here the same nanostructure as this one here, as this one here? And what we found as we've gone across this, as long as the humidity in the lab is within a given range and the student mixed everything up the right way, we can get the same material over and over and over and over again. It's because this is all driven from a thermodynamics perspective in terms of the self-assembly, you're not going to get a perfect assembly, but the number of defects is actually quite small because the hydrogen bonding does wonderful things to be able to drive really long range order. And so we've found not really any super huge variability and stuff unless we wanted to put it in there, which is sort of the nice thing.
So you're going to fabricate this material in a roll-to-roll system and you end up with a film, right? A web, a film. So how does that get configured into a battery? What's the form factor?
So the issue right now is the furnace we don't have configured to do the roll-to-roll in. So what we've been doing is taking that big film that we've made and basically crushing, that one there, and we just crush it up into things and throw it into a ceramic tray and throw it in a furnace.
You just crumble it up.
And then we take the crumbled up pieces, make a slurry with that, just like you do a normal battery fabrication, and everything fabricates the same way. Now ideally you'd want to keep that thing together and be able to process it, and then you have the continuous pathways, everything else. These things are a little bit more brittle than I would like when they carbonize.
So the carbonization makes it brittle, I guess? Yeah.
Okay. I mean, so the ways around that could be adding in, during the synthesis, if you add in some graphene sheets, if you go to some carbon precursors actually give you stuff that's much more flexible. So some of the polyimides actually give you a little bit more flexible carbons at the end of the day. But then you have a cost difference between that and plywood, you know, so.
What was the temperature of the oven?
For those ones there, I think it was about 800 C.
And how long?
That one there, we've taken it down to about 25 minutes. We have a microwave right now that we've got that's a high temperature, several megawatt microwave that we can get up to 1900 C in. And so if we mix in graphite powders with these materials, originally, I can carbonize the whole thing in about 20 seconds.
What was the temperature that you originally cited in your furnace?
In the furnace, there's 800 C.
800 C.
Yeah. So it's not huge, but not tiny for polymer.
You can put a microwave on the roll. It's been done in the rubber industry, you know, for curing the rubber. That's easy enough. All you need is interlocks.
Yeah.
That's cool. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks.